I'm not actually going to talk entirely about the medieval borough, because there's too much in Henderson's poetry that is wider than that. And you will find out, I've actually given you the text, or I will be giving you the text of the pieces of Henderson that I'm reading out. Unfortunately, I think those of you out at the very back may not be able to read them, because I think it's quite small pointed by the time it gets up to there. But hopefully, you will be able to follow the reading. We may not know a great deal about Robert Henderson, the man, teacher, and poet, but his excellent work gave us a pretty comprehensive and detailed picture of life in the medieval borough in which he lived, and the conditions under which he lived, sought to live, work, and suffer. Henderson followed James I in the King's Square, Holland in the Books of Owlet, and Harry Wallace, accepted Aristotle's view that poetry is an essentially practical discipline, justified by its effect in persuading people to good action, as he says in the prologue to the Moral Fable. Another cause why the fable first began was to repeat the of Enid's living old man, the figure of another thing. That's why he's writing fables, using animals as the symbols of narrative for man. And like many others who have lost their ears, tried to labour it with great diligence, singers the clueless and the drawing of ears, Nielsen and Boots the man is come to them. The singers there and laurel feats intend due to the subtle light of poetry, to good purpose. Why could it be applied? The nut is shell, though it be hard and tooth, how does the kernel reach the lion there in doctrine lies in you, and full of fruit under an extended table. It might remind you of something of what Richard said about the environmental conditions in the course of some of what I'm saying. This is absolutely traditional and conventional the use to which tables have been put since the time of Aesop at least. Fables were staples of the schoolroom and could be enjoyed as reading matter while the intended message was famously adored. But Henderson in his view was many traditional tales to be referred to the matter. By observing both the world and that in the future, he is more likely to convince them of the truth of his words, where social commentary competes with philosophical, Christian, and metaphysical lessons. Most of the evidence, which will be examined this morning, is found in the Moral Fable, composed by Henderson variously on originals of Aesop, and mediated by the versions of Walter of Anglicus in historical Latin algebraic, the Romans of Manas, and Chaucer. It would be tedious to go through the fables in order, picking out the relevant parts. So instead, I shall look thematically at the work, moving forwards and backwards as appropriate. And to pick up where David left off at the end of his talk, I'm starting with the world's newest time, beginning indeed with the God-ordained and ruled universe around us, as is seen in the opening stanzas of the preaching of the swallows. The high prudence and working marvellous, the profound wit of God's omnipotence, is sacrificed and sat ingenious, excelleth far all man's judgment. Names could presume beneath their natural, pierce the secrets of the Trinity, but shroud firmly and must all it should be. Yet nevertheless, we may have knowledging of God on meditation in creatures, that he is good, fair, wise, and benign. The firmament painted, the sternest clear, beneath the west, rolleth in circle room, and ever the planet in his proper sphere, in moving, lacking harmony and tune. The fire, the air, the water, shall understand the good and unity with, that God in all his work is witty is. Here we have the unquestioning acknowledgement of a world created for God, according to the account of the Bible, and know the only good faith of following the call. We are two speculative and sensible people to understand the God's truth. Here also we have the Aristotelian astronomical explanation, with the fixed stars and planets on crystal spheres revolving from east to west and creating the music of the spheres as they do so. This is seen in greater detail in Fox and the Wolf, where Lawrence the Fox contemplates the night sky from a hilltop viewpoint, where he must see the twinkling stern and sphere, and all the planets of the firmament, their course, and even the moving in their spheres, some retrograde and some stationary, and of the zodiac in what degree they were of age. But astrolabe, quadrant or almanac, teachers of nature the instruction, the moving of the heavens is towards in time, what influence and constellation would like to fall upon the earth do. The planetary spheres were thought to move from east to west. If a planet appeared to be moving from west to east, it was retrograde, and if it had no apparent motion, it was stationary. The purpose of astronomy was to predict eclipses and other momentous events, and to indicate propitious times for human action. Sometimes create two possible celestial conjunctions in a number of tables to give the reader a hint of the story to come. A similar detail is found in Orpheus and Eurydice, when Orpheus is undertaking his search for the dead Eurydice through the planetary sphere, each ruled by its own god or goddess. Orpheus travels by Woodland Street, not the Roman road from London, but actually the Milky Way, to the highest sphere, that of Saturn, what father is of all their storm and soul. Then to that of Jupiter, Mars, the god of Saturn and strife, Phoebus, god of the sun, with Venus rift and fear, Venus, Mercury, god of eloquence, all without success, although he did learn something. Oh, and there's the Aristotelian cosmos, which shows there four elements in the middle, with fire and drops of light from the air, and all the planets still there to be continuing round. In his passage among the planets all, he heard a heavenly melody, and soon passing all instrumentous musical, caused it to be rolling at the sphere of moon. Built harmony through all this muscle moon, for moving said, unite perpetual, built of this world, Plato the soul in soul. By finding it's got the story of harmony, its essence consisting in those perfect mathematical ratios which are the law of the universe and the music of the heavenly spheres. In Plato's Timaeus, we find an account derived from the Pythagorean sources of the origin of the soul. First, the world soul is created according to the laws of mathematical symmetry and musical concord. It is composed of two elements, one an element of sameness, corresponding to the universal and intelligible order of truth, and the other an element of distinction or otherness, corresponding to the world of sensible and particular existences. The individual human soul is constructed on the same plan. In Platonic doctrine, soul and body have distinct orders of reality, and the body is the prison, the tomb. For Saul, with sensuality, speculative and treasure corporal, we may not clearly understand nor see God as he is, nor God as celestial. Through a milk of deeply corrupt material, blindness and spiritual operation, like a dream man were abundant in prison. Here he is, as he takes himself, following Aristotle, who said in Metaphysics, that man is called like a battlefield, Terim and wake, the sun she may not see, Sana is her soul with fantasy of breath, to know the things in nature manifest. So that's the world view of the mentality of the people of the time, but they, of course, were living in the world that we know. If the celestial kingdom was perfectly ordered and symmetrical, the sublunary world at this period was very unevenly divided into the majority rural and minority urban settlements, seen very clearly in their polar opposition in Emerson's session on the fable of the two mites. Emerson, despite spending most of his working life in a town, gives a more detailed picture of the rural landscape and way of living, which makes one think that he saw more that was appealing to him in rural life. In the preaching that follows, Henderson, imagining the narrator enjoying the more reasonable weather after the privations of winter, gives us a very clear picture of the spring activities which would have been seen in the fields around his farmland at this time. Some were in dyke, and some were drunk in wine. Some sowing seed is fast from place to place, the harrow is hoppened in the sower straight. The little homely touch of the harrow popping over the unevenness of the ground as it covers the seed is delightful, and so very well observed. And this is a point that Paul Smith actually made to us, Paul Smith of Linlithgow, who studied Henderson over many years, in a very interesting talk several years ago to the Robert Henderson Society. But Henderson Judaism had its very deep country prescriptions in Jerusalem, and as a central activity of this poem is the growing and harvesting of flax with eight necks to catch small birds, he gives us a complete account of the whole process from sowing to final product. Thus passed at first full June, that jolly tide, and seeds that were sown up before were growing high. Let's hear it, let's come high, and ask the quail you taken in the corn. The lint like it, the cow pull at the lint, ripple at the bollocks and the beak is set. It steepeth in the burn and dry its sign, and within drizzle knocketh it and bed. Sign swingled at heel and heckled in the flesh. His wife it stands and twines to sit the tree, or quilts the fowl of Nessus made in wheat. There's a reference in the Borough Record of 1486 for flax seed to be sown in the Netherlands from south of the town, flax and linen similarly in 1489-1499. As this was land close to the Abbey confines, Henderson could easily have been walking by these fields watching the labour. Small birds trapped in the flax and nets and then sifted for roasting were an important part of the peasant diet, a good source of fresh protein at the time of year when there was no fresh mutton and beef to be had. During the more temperate parts of the year, the peasants had a good and varied diet of oatmeal, meat, usually mutton or beef, dairy products, sometimes fish, supplemented with oysters and mussels, although they did not have access to a particularly wide range of vegetables at that time. In The Fox Who Wrote on a Husbandman, Henderson describes the sight of a husbandman taking his untrained and thrifty oxen for their first ploughing of the year. This would probably be one of a peasant community of smallholders renting land from a superior lord, each of whom would provide a pair of oxen for the eight needed to pull the heavy plough. There was in husband, but had his good flute to hear. Early in the morning, the ball thrust his spear unto the flute, what his gadman had eaten, his stock he thrust with benedicted day. The caller cry at how, yake, upon he cried sick. Paul Brock, my dow, sang broader than full fair. The oxen was unused, young and lit, and for fierceness they could the first for fair. The husband man walked angry as a hare, sang quiet and gave his papal and his great stay. In the old method of ploughing, two men were employed, a ploughman who held the plough, and a gadman, a goad man or caller, driver, who led on and urged the oxen. It was very difficult for the ploughman to keep the plough in the furrow, since the oxen all tied to one pole tended to get out of line. The gadman would try to keep them straight by prodding or beating them with a goad. The ploughman would throw implements or stones at the hindmost of them and keep them here. Although this husbandman brings his troubles on himself by crushing his unruly cattle, Henderson is very aware of the precariousness of peasant life. The fable, The Wolf and the Lamb, where a lamb is persecuted and finally eaten by a wolf which accuses him totally unreasonably and illegally of something he has not done, is explained in the Moralita. The poor people, this man may signify, as male men, merchants, and all labourers, of whom the life is passed in purgatory, to win with mortal living has appeared. The wolf has taken false extortioners, and oppressors of poor men who see the veils of craft and subtlety. Henderson says there are three kinds of wolves in the world. The first, false perverters of the law, who for a bud the poor man overthrows, more than the rest gan than last receive. The second, powerful and avaricious landlords, who will not leave the poor man in peace, but are in his heat and his mailing will they tax, giving the tenancy to offer more for it. The third wolf is the landowner, who leases out his land, but then torments his tenants until they leave, or forces them to work for him, rather than winning their own living. His horse, his mare, he man lends to the lair, to drug and draw and change the carriage. His servants are his destiny, not to spare, to swing and sweep without a need of rage. Thus he stands in labour and bondage, that scantily may be purchased by his mail to live upon dry leaves and waxed hair. Rather than farming his own land to produce his livelihood and sustain his family, the peasant in this circumstance gives all his labour for the laird's benefit. Although not actually serfdom, which has disappeared by the late 14th century, this kind of thirlage, where the peasant had to have his grain milled at the laird's mill and pay for the privilege, or had to give his labour when the laird required it and could not hope to be able to bequeath his rented farm to his son, as it could simply be rented by his bidder after his death, is different only in name. Henderson is very alert to the many instances of injustice justice that he must have seen her out in. One of the strongest expressions of this is found in The Sheep and the Dog, where a blatantly fraudulent court is kept up the very situation being ludicrous if it were not so serious. As a notary, Henderson would be very familiar with the workings of the court, and it is seen throughout the fables that he uses a good deal of legal jargon, as here. The summons to the sheep, made by incorrigible Wolfe as judge, uses the common style of medieval Scots law. I, Mr. Wolfe, part of the sword and gun, under the pains of high to say to you, of this custom and institution. Just see, I judge thee straightly to hear and answer to his door before me hear. Now, what is interesting about this summons is that it is to the consistory court, the church court, rather than to the civil borough court. There are similar cases in the borough of the fight, dealing with the riot with Holden, approved the money, expense and the money. While most sentences were designed for public humiliation, like stalks and the cup stool, and in fact, when you see the wood on the library at lunchtime, you will see somebody dipping in the stalks. The sentence of person, a much more serious penalty involving excommunication for non-payment of debt, is also available as this sentence here. And given the primacy of the church in the minds of people of the time, excommunication was an incredibly serious affair. Henderson's court is stacked against the sheep from the outset. The wolf is the judge, the raven the summoner, the fox clerk and notary public, the kite and vulture, the dog's advocate, all enemies to the sheep. While he has no one to support him or to plead for him against the dog's claimer, in certain breed worth 5 shillings on there. The unquestioned assumption of the amount of the debt is another scandal, as the bread could not possibly be worth this much. And indebted to Pat Dennison, who's already been mentioned, for a note in the records of a feast where the total amount spent on bread was one shilling and sixpence. £2 something was spent on drink for the same feast. The fraudulent nature of the court and the charge are stressed throughout the table, but there's no sign of there any way out for the condemned sheep, who had finally to sell his own fleece to buy the bread to pay back the dog, and thus go into the winter without the protection of his own wound. I'm not suggesting that this is the kind of case that would be heard in the borough court, but that Henderson is using the fable to point a moral message, there would be no point in using examples that were totally alien to his audience. A rather similar case is found in the borough records for 1496, where one Andrew Lister compareth in judgment and assured to the bailies that he was come in a great debt, with a good debt to be held under the sentence of Cursor, so the excommunication was threatened to him, and that he had now good movable to release him of the said debt, bought his land that he was in. If this man were forced to give up his land to pay his debt, he would not be able to earn a living for himself or his family, and would be left destitute like the sheep in the stable. So perhaps it's not too much of an exaggeration. The Preaching of the Swallow also details the calendar of the year, where Henderson begins his description of the year with summer, but he ends appropriately with the planting season of spring, coming after the dark winter season. And as Richard pointed out, some of the climatic changes, in Scotland currently, after the last few washout summers, it's rather difficult to read Henderson's idyllic picture of the summer with its jolly mantle green, with lurid fair furrows on ever old felt, fence, and heat and moisture still in from the sun, the moisture, but not heat still in from the sky. And even less so, thine harvest cake, when Ceres, that goddess, has rather seen its hands with Abaddon, where we used to flood rather than heat. But there's no reason to believe that apart from those times of famine, the family was not well provided with fruitful harvest of the season. Indeed, the inhabitants of the borough depended on the produce of the rural hinterland for their survival. However, life was not all warm summers and hot harvests, and Henderson shows his realism by giving 2 stanzas to winter, which each of the other seasons had one. Sign winter wan, when Oster Iola, god of the wind, with blasted body, all the green garments of summer glorious, are all friends and driven in pieces small. And who has seen a beast that bear a bliss, be wicked windeth of the winter wear, and you can hear the alliteration from the winds and the beating of the leaves on the trees. Going to find the animals of Venice, cushion for cold and coppers then to keep. This applies equally to the human inhabitants who had to sit out the winter keeping them down board as well as they could, and probably wishing that they could hibernate into two until it was over. Perhaps those living in the borough could be thought to have had a rather easier time than the rural population, but they were ultimately dependent on the population in the surrounding lands for their food, although there was a thriving trade of bulk goods such as hay, the table which shows us some aspects of urban life and which highlights the tension between town and country owing to the growth of the borough and their drain on the hinterland is the Two Mice, where we are introduced to two mice. Alphan the eldest dwelt in a borough toon with Gil's brother and made of three birches, called three alps and freedom had to go wherever she lived, and I would even be with it after. This mouse is a member of the Merchant Guild, which in the 15th century would have controlled the for export dues, which in the seaport boroughs were paid upon the wool, felt, skins and hides that were traded overseas, and the petty customs paid on produce which was bought for sale at the Crown Market. A burgess would be in his person as we come and go as he wished, in direct contrast with a thorough tenant farmer on his superior land. To be a burgess was a responsible position in the borough, and all burgesses could hold burgess tenure and were involved in the borough council, which monitored all aspects of town life. In the Dunfermline, there were quite a number of women burgesses, as can be seen from the borough records, and a widow of a mill member could take on her husband's position and continue his trade. Catherine Brough, sister of the common clerk of Dunfermline, adding her signature to the Dunfermline Borough Court Book in 1493, showing that she was from an educated family. A widow, if she did not have a son, could hand on her deceased husband's membership of the Merchant Guild to her new husband. Burgess plots held by burgesses were laid out in a pretty uniform fashion along the principal street of the town. In Dunfermline, there are frontage of 22.5 feet, usually, with some smaller and some slightly larger. These plots ran from the street back, and usually had a house built at the front, firstly a simple thatched wooden structure, but gradually becoming more sophisticated with loft, cellars, four stairs, with workshops, middens, wells, outhouses, gardens, and places for animals in the rearward parts of the plot. One of the early fables perhaps gives a slight flavour of these Burgess plots, where valuable objects carelessly discarded could end up on the household rubbish tip or midden. In Cox sometime, with bedroom fresh and gay, who'd work upon a dunghill soon be day, he found in Jolly Jack the refugious with Captain Thornton sweeping at the hoose. As damsels wanton and insolent that fain would play and on the street be seen, to swapping of the hoose did that not end, but be their ends while at the floor be clean. Gerald are since as oft times has been seen upon the floor and swap it forth and on. You can almost see the pursed lip and the lagging finger here in the distant room. See these young women that are reading about. Henderson tells us something of the home life of the Dunfermline Burgess in the Two Mice when he takes us into the pantry, well stocked with a range of foods, where the town mouse makes her residence. They cheese and butter upon the skeleton pie, flesh and fish, chinook, baked fresh and salt, and take a spool of grossest meal and malt, mutton and beef, sticking and delicate grapes, and lord of fair, they stuffed cheese and cooper feet. In plate of grossest and dish full of meal, brass cake is up, and trout should spare it not, abundantly about her first meal, and main full fine she brought into the field. An ain white candle, out of ain copper stall, and see the spice, she got up their moose withal. This is absolutely typical of the diet of the time, varied and wholesome, produced either from the Burgess plot itself or by trade with their rural peasants bringing their goods into the borough market. However, Henderson's point in this fable is that the good life, as lived by the townhouse, is susceptible to the vicissitudes of fortune in the way that the simpler life of the country mouse is not. As the younger mouse responds to her sister's question about whether this life is better than what she knows, ye damn for sure. But who lying while it left? The comparisons with the Lenten fast and Easter feasting in this fable also suggest that Henderson thought there was a danger to the soul in continually living well. When Gib Hunter, where Jolly Cat breaks up the feast, we are given a further description of the decor of a typical Burgess house. The cat catches the inexperienced country mouse and plays with her in another beautifully observed set piece. From foot to foot he kept her to and fro, while doing this, tasted on his kid, while did he let her run under the straw. The straw would of course be the floor covering, the thresh, a straw or rushes mixed with sweet smelling herbs, both to provide some cushioning and a little warmth against the earthen or stone floor, and to be easily swept, where it's easy to see how anything dropped could be lost forever, or swept out onto the linen, as in the cock and the jam. This house has wall coverings as well, both the dozer or cloth wall hanging, and paralleling or tapestry, which in this instance allow the mouse to climb out of the cat's reach. This is the kind of furnishing which would be usual in a burgess house at the time, and Henderson has no criticism of this, except where it's the result of social climbing, rising above one's station in life, and making possession the most important part of life. He warns that people in this condition are endangering their mortal souls. Great abundance and blind prosperity of kindness makes an ill conclusion. There are another references in other poems to slithery wenchy, which would be the medieval equivalent of our coat and a shingly peg, warning that position should be involved at once. As in The Wolf and the Weather, where a sheep from the flock offers to take the place of the deceased sheepdog and frighten off a marauding wolf. As a companion piece to the following, The Wolf and the Lamb, this is a quite hilarious fable, until the denouement, of course, when everything goes wrong. Here may thou see that riches of array will cause poor men presumptuous for to be, while some man sits their heels through their head. But yet name wait who line that rule will ring, that he was wise that bade his son consider, beware in wealth, for hal bent are bent slither. This sounds very similar to the exhortation in the morale chapter, which in mind is essential for simplicity and security. The sweetest life, therefore, in this country is sickerness, the small present you. In this instance, of course, sickerness is more likely to mean spiritual security, as we've seen that no state is entirely secure, but then those living a simple, unostentatious life are less likely to be persecuted. The garment of good ladies gives further advice to live according to one's given state in life, in a poem which is similar and drawn into the inventory of armour, but is one of the earliest examples describing a woman's clothing. Of course, this clothing is symbolic of honour, good governance, chastity, constancy and the like, but the garments themselves are likely to be what virtuous women and innocent and vermin would have been wearing around town. The outfit comprised of dark or loose shifts as undergarments, remember Cuffy Stark in Robert Burns' Sam O'Shanter, a kirtle or bodice and skirt worn under the outer gown, which could be adorned with ribbons and embroidery, and even trimmed with fur. A belt clasped the waist, which was shaped by the kirtle, and sleeves were separate from the gown, tied with laces to keep them in place. Married women in particular would cover their hair with some kind of hood, and she might well have a tippet, or tippet, a long strip of fabric attached to the apex of the hood and hanging down. She would have a papillet around her neck in the upper part of her chest, and a half ribbon round her neck, presumably like the modern choker. It seems to be important that her temptingly attractive features should be hidden from view, as with the papillet hiding her girth and the girth hiding her thin ears there. Her shoes are of thickness in thin that show not slide, rather than stopping her from sliding into the mud of the street, and her hose of honesty keeping her legs covered. This has been a far from exhaustive examination of Henderson's poems, and it will have been noted by those familiar with the work that there's been no reference at all to his best-known work, Sense and Impressive. The most salient feature that I would pick out of this poem would be the reference to John Hospital at the Trinity End, the hospital at St Leonard's, operative from Effort, which is one of the buildings which has been identified by the Borough Survey. This hospital is known to have supported 8 widows who were supplying with donations of meat, malt, wheat and groat, harvested from 64 acres of land adjacent. Lectures was common in the medieval period, and most major towns had a liquor house outside the confines of the house of the town to minimise contact as they realised it was contagious. Another building which has been identified in the Borough Survey is the grammar school where Henderson likely taught. The Borough's lead sign in 1496 cites the grammar school at the northeast corner of Rossy Row, now Queen Anne Street. At the top of the school gate, and the Infernal Borough Records for 1525 refer to a property in the Rathmere of Erfurt Solan Grammatic Column, which is opposite the grammar school, which is a school for outsiders to the Abbey. commonly accepted that this was where Henderson lived, taught, and distilled his learning and his observation of the urban and rural world at work. Thus, rural world around him is some of his great